Before we get into this week's podcast, I wanted to tell you about a report from Tim Clouk, who is the council's oversight of Grandview finances. The report says that Grandview's tithe income to December 20th is $391,000, leaving us with $84,000 to raise by December 31st to reach our tithe budget for 2020. Compared to last year at this time, we are $7,000 ahead. Good job. To support the work of Grandview for this fiscal year by December 31st, please go to gcbchurch.ca/giving. Thanks. 4 years ago, I went on an adventure. My friend Joe needed some time and space to regrow his liver because he gave half of his to his mom. While his liver grew, Joe asked me to fill in as pastor for a while. So off I went up to Telqua, BC, a 12-hour drive north. It was the end of November, so it was only light out for like 15 minutes a day. It was the first time in my life that I wasn't with my family for American Thanksgiving. The only people I knew were either regrowing their liver or tending to people regrowing their liver while taking care of tiny humans. I was lonely, homesick, and getting familiar with the dark. Every clear night, I would go outside the farmhouse I was staying at and look out over the horizon. A big, bald mountain glowed in moonlight. The mountain reminded me of Mount Baker and home. There were two owls that would fly in and out of the house lights, and they were there every single night. It was a cozy place, aside from the cold. The mountain and owls made me a little less homesick and lonely. The mountain and owls weren't the reason I went outside. I went out to try and see the Northern Lights. I've always wanted to see the Northern Lights, but every time I've been far enough north to have a chance, it wasn't a dark enough time of year. So when I finally got the chance, I bundled up, shuffled outside into the darkness, and looked up north, hoping to see some electrons colliding with the Earth's magnetic field. This season of Advent is a season marked by lonely homesickness, darkness, and hope. Those flavors are the appetizer for the main course, the thing hoped for. Advent is anticipation. This week, for our Sunday offering, we will go through those anticipatory themes and flavors into the celebration of the main course. So welcome to This Grandview Life. My name is Jake Tucker. I'll be your host as we start our journey into the Christmas celebration. We will start in lonely homesickness. Act 1, Exile. Jeremiah chapter 29, verses 1 and 10 through 14. This is the text of the letter that the prophet Jeremiah sent from Jerusalem to the surviving elders among the exiles and to the priests, the prophets, and all the other people Nebuchadnezzar had carried into exile from Jerusalem to Babylon. This is what the Lord says. When 70 years are completed for Babylon, I will come to you and fulfill my good promise to bring you back to this place. For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord. Plans to prosper you and not to harm you. Plans to give you hope and a future. Then you will call on me and come and pray to me, and I will listen to you. You will seek me and find me when you seek me with all your heart. I will be found, declares the Lord, and will bring you back from captivity. I will gather you from all the nations and places where I have banished you, declares the Lord, and I will bring you back to the place from which I carried you into exile.
Oh,
So a lot of themes of Advent and Christmas come out of this shared experience of exile. When the people of Judah were removed from their homeland, exile becomes a paradigmatic experience for understanding the break in relationship between God and God's people. One of the dominant voices that wrote about that exile was Jeremiah. Now, through the grace of the communion of saints, we are able to sit down and have a conversation with Jeremiah to help us get a perspective on this experience. So we're honored to have Jeremiah here with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. You know, I appreciate it. Usually for this time of year, Isaiah's the one getting called. People forget that I'm a major prophet too.
Isn't that minor prophet, major prophet distinction more about the amount a prophet wrote, not about how important they are?
Well, I mean, that's what we tell Joel and Amos and all those guys. But I mean...
So can you tell us a bit about your work as a prophet?
Well, prophets aren't usually too popular. I definitely wasn't. The basic gist of the job description is you tell people what God tells you. God told me some unhappy things. While I was a prophet, a lot of people in Jerusalem were forced to move to Babylon. At that point, everyone and their mother wanted to hear from God. They all wanted to hear the same thing. They wanted God to tell them they'd get to go home.
Is that what God said?
Oh, no. Well, not immediately. God told me to tell them that their kids' kids would get to come home. God wanted the homesick exiles to get cozy because Babylon was their home for now.
And how'd they take that bit of news?
Oh, they weren't happy. They tried to get other people to pose as prophets and tell them the news they wanted to hear. It was a hard time for the exiles because home, Jerusalem, was a huge deal. It was more than a place on a map. It was an identity. Just looking around the scenery told you who you were. Up there is where great-great-great-granddad almost got sacrificed by great-great-great-great-granddad. But God showed up and provided a ram. Down there, just to the left of the peak that looks like a crippled goat, down in the valley, that's where Joshua took our ancestors through a dry riverbed. That was when God gave us this special place, because we were his special people. The land is story. It tells us who we are, reminds us of our relationship with God. It's our identity.
So how did the move from Jerusalem to Babylon affect the exiles?
It was disorienting. Jerusalem is all hills and mountains. Each have a story telling you where you are and who you are. Babylon was a flat floodplain. The scenery was all man-made buildings. The most prominent were dedicated to gods that weren't Israel's God. The folks who had to move were in a tight spot. They had to rethink what made them them, and what it means to be God's special people living in a place that wasn't the promised land. That kind of identity rethinking is scary and hard. It left folks feeling pretty sad.
How did it make you feel to write bad news to a sad people?
Well, the bad news was true, and truth is a good thing. The bad news wasn't all bad, like I was saying. God was going to bring people home eventually. Their time away was going to change them, give them a more mature idea of what it means to be God's people. That was the good news that I got to tell the exiles, though it wasn't the good news they wanted. I've thought about that good news. I think there's something about waiting and hoping for God that makes us grow. It's maturing. Even in a sad place, far from home, having to rethink what it means to be you, that future hope works like yeast in a bread, growing, flavoring, forming, and shaping. Eventually, that time away from home, hoping for God to come to the rescue and renew, that time in exile does some amazing things to a people. You know, in the end, I trust that God is up to nothing but good for people. So even in the midst of being sad about giving mostly bad news to people I loved, I felt hope. And hope does some wild things to a person's innards.
Thank you, Jeremiah.
And you know the sun's setting fast, just like they say, nothing good ever lasts. Go on now and kiss a goodbye, boy. hold on to your lover, cause your heart's bound to die. Go on now, say goodbye to our town, to our town. Can't you see the sun setting down on our town, on our town, tonight? Up the street beside that red neon light, that's where I met my baby on one hot summer night. He was the tender and I ordered a beer. It's been 40 years and I'm still sitting here. But you know the sun's setting fast, and just like they say, nothing could ever last. Go on now and kiss it goodbye, but hold on to your lover, cause your heart's bound to die. Go on now and say goodbye to our town, to our town. Can't you see the sun setting down on our town, on our town, tonight?
Advent and Christmas are all about candles and light, which also means they're a little bit about darkness. In Act 2 of our show, we look at that theme, darkness. Isaiah chapter 9, verse 2. The people walking in darkness have seen a great light. On those living in the land of deep darkness, a light has dawned.
The first question is, has there ever been a time that you were afraid of the dark? What was that like?
Maybe when we were playing flashlight tag and then I was hiding and then one of the person that was it just like jumps out on it.
It's usually when I watch a movie that's filmed in the dark, because for some reason my body reacts to the stuff that I watched or saw only when it's in that, like, particular place. Like, in the water, I'm scared of sharks. In the dark, I'm scared of this guy from Harry Potter.
The one who must not be named?
Yes.
Yes.
So every time it's dark in the basement, I get so terrified. If I'm not with my grandma, I literally freak out and run up the stairs. She's like, there's nothing wrong with it. And I'm like, I've been petrified of it for, like, I don't know what it is. My cousin told me that when we slept down there, like, because with all my cousins, she told me that there was kidnappers who'd kidnap me. And I was so terrified. And I was like 6 or something. And I was so terrified. I've always been terrified of it.
Why do you think so many people have experiences where they find themselves in the dark and then they're scared suddenly? Sadie, what do you think?
Well, I think that people are scared of the dark because it is a dark place. We live in a world with the sun, and we fall asleep at night when that's the only place that it's kind of dark.
Huh.
So, like, I think it's kind of like you're used to the light, and just everything goes out.
Huh.
You cannot see anything.
Huh.
Probably because you just don't know what's there. The unexpectedness of, like, something gonna, who's there but you can't see, even though you can see everybody else, even though it's dark.
Well, I think it's probably the fact that people are so used to seeing things and light, but when you're in the darkness, you're afraid of tripping, falling, something jumping out at you, and you don't know. It's, yeah. It just, all of the above that could happen in your mind, so it's swirling with all the thoughts of what could happen because you don't know what's in front of you or behind you or beside you, so you can't predict what's going to happen. And I find that people feel very afraid when they find uncertainty and they don't know what to do and they panic.
People get scared when they see nothing. Like, everything is, like, gone.
What do you guys think helps when you're in the dark?
Under the covers!
Oh, is under the covers, like, that's a cozy, safe place to be when it's dark?
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree.
My unicorn. It's a glow-up unicorn.
Wait, what? You have a glow-up unicorn?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh.
No, it's not really dark under the covers, though.
Okay.
It's like a kindergarten thing, but I think my blanket makes me feel all comfy, like it's a hug, like a ton of people are surrounding me with warmness. But I think warmness in the dark is really nice.
Something that you're used to. You know that's there and it's not gonna change. And say for me, I have this bear that I've had since before I was born, and its name's Everhart. But it's nice to know he's there.
Yeah.
Not gonna change.
And maybe talking when somebody else is in the dark, it's really nice just to know that somebody is with you.
What's your names, and how long have you guys been involved with East Side Story Guild?
So I'm Siri, and I've been involved with ESG for about 12 years now, through different roles as being an actor, but then also more recently doing some backstage work.
I'm Gilbert. I've been involved in Eastside for 10 years now. This is my 10th, 11th? I don't know. But I've been involved, acting, and then more recently been doing backstage and some of the behind the scenes work.
Mm-hmm. I was wondering if you could take us through step by step how you get the sanctuary into a theater.
We need to get the window blacks up and need to get, and that includes the windows in the sanctuary and then the windows all around the, behind the stage and around, like there's windows outside the sanctuary that also affect our light and the doorways as well. The first step is to get the major window blacks out. They're stored in the attic. They get hauled down, and then if they've been wrapped right, we can take them and put them directly, set them underneath the windows that they correspond to. If they haven't, we have to unwrap them and check where they go.
And then next we get to take out the big ladder, and then we'll set up the blacks, putting them on the hooks above the windows. And then kind of after we hook them, we can it all just cascades down as you release it. And I don't know, I always find that part very entertaining, just the trickle down of it, because it always usually falls quite smoothly. So it's kind of like a little bit of a waterfall falling down. So, yeah.
And once we've got all the windows blacked out, then we have to get any residual lighting, what residual blacks that are not, we don't have major black panels for. So that includes things like doors, the windows, in the entrance from the stairs to the sanctuary.
In this process, what are the sketchiest moments?
The back of the sanctuary, the two blinds against the back of the room are quite difficult to do because there's pews in the way there, and because we are trying to be efficient with our time, we normally don't bother moving the pews or the soundboard, and that's difficult. So we have to prop the ladder up against the wall, and it's much more leaning and trying to hook the blacks onto those hooks. It's a much more difficult process than the regular blacks.
So how much time are we talking about? How long do you think it takes to black out the sanctuary?
I think we've probably gotten it down to under 30 minutes at this point.
Yeah, when we started, it was definitely a learning curve. And then
a few hours at least
to
do it. But now I think I could probably, with a team of around 6 people, because we have to take them down from the attic, and because they're stored up high in the attic, and that takes a bit of time to get them down. But we could probably get them up in less than half an hour.
So with the sketchiness and all the work, do you think it's worth getting the theater all dark?
I find that not necessarily for setting up lighting, but for when we're actually doing performances and we want to be able to see the lights, we can't really see them in the daytime at all. So to be able to really see, to be able to create lighting contrast in the space, it definitely is helpful.
And from an actor's point of view, because that's what I prefer to do for the most part, I find that because like during rehearsals, we won't have the blacks out because it's just way too much work and we don't have the time, but we're just kind of in that rehearsal mode. But I find that when the kids see the blacks kind of going up, when I see the blacks going up, it kind of this mentality switch in a bit that, okay, now we're coming into this space where we're going to be showing this to the rest of the congregation and to other members of the community. So it's kind of that shift of like, okay, this is when we actually have to put in like focus, bring all of this hard work together. And it's just kind of this culmination of all of that. And it's like, okay, the blocks are up. It's now showtime. Because especially on the Sunday shows, because like during the beginning of the worship, the blinds are open. And then as we're kind of moving towards the showtime, like people go around and are like dropping the blinds. And I always sense this type of shift in a bit. It's like, okay, now we're going to be going into this.
So this is Jen. She is the theater director of East Side Story Guild. Is that the right title?
Artistic director. Yeah, same thing.
All right.
Yeah.
So I thought it'd be good to ask you a few questions about our theme of darkness today. But first, I wanted to ask, what drew you to theater?
Yeah. Well, I was first introduced to theater when I was in grade 6. I was cast in the elementary school Christmas play as a toy doll. And so it was my first time being on a stage and getting to be a character, and I just loved it. I felt like my whole person just came alive, and expressing myself through acting and just being in a whole other world than reality was just so fun. And I was a total drama geek, and then I studied it in university and became a drama teacher. I love the feeling of being in the audience and watching a show.
A question that I had is, why are theaters so dark?
Well, they're dark so that the audience's eye is focused to the action on stage. So theater is very much a sensory experience. It involves all your senses, and it's also a relational experience. It's the only art form that has to be done live. It needs an audience to exist. And so the audience is seated, and all of a sudden there's this quiet, there's a hush in the crowd because the lights are dimming. And so, of course, everything around you is kind of muted because it's dark, and so you're not distracted. So your whole attention is turned towards the stage. And the theater lights shine on whatever action you need to see on stage, whatever object, whatever actor, whatever image the director, the lighting designer has chosen for you to look at. A good example is actually from the painting world. Rembrandt used darkness in his paintings to show his subjects even more, because he would paint the subject in the middle, and then all around the subject he'd do dark, dark shades of brown and blue and black. And so because of that, because it was so dark around the subject, your eye is immediately drawn to the middle, the subject. And he was often called the master of light because he just used dark and light in a way that really made you catch your attention and look at what was lit, what was illuminated. And another favorite painter of mine, Bob Ross, who's a little more contemporary, said, "We need darkness to show the beauty and brilliance of the light."
From your perspective, what does darkness enable in storytelling in theater?
I think it really helps us focus on the image. It draws in our attention. It helps us to like zone in on on what? Forget about everything else. Everything else becomes dark except for the thing that is lit. And actually, some things cannot be accomplished in theater unless we have dark. So one example I can give you is last year I saw a show at Pacific Theater. It was a Christmas Carol, and it was a one-person show. So Ron Reed was the actor, and he did all of the characters. He performed all the different parts. And it was the scene where I believe it was the ghost of Christmas past was coming to visit him, Scrooge. And so because it was just one actor on stage, they couldn't have another actor be the ghost. So what they did was he had a candle that he blew out, and the smoke somehow, with their lighting technique, the smoke turned into a figure. It was so creepy. It was like a ghost was really in the room. So that only happened because there was hardly any light, and whatever light they had, it was backlit. And so the smoke, it was so dark in the theater, so the smoke was seen just from a little bit of backlighting. It was a really cool effect. Yeah, so we need the dark to tell stories.
Our final act is a reflection on and movement into the reason for the season. For Act 3 of our show, we are looking at hope. To help us think about that theme of hope, I interviewed a group of preteens.
What is something that you really hope will happen soon?
Like seeing my cousins again.
I hope that we as a soccer team can play soccer games again really soon.
What does it feel like to hope? If hope was a room temperature, like, would it be cold, super hot, kind of cozy? What does hope feel like?
It's like warm. You're waiting for it to get warm, or you're waiting, like, whatever temperature your favorite, say your favorite was cold, then it'd be like in the middle waiting for it to go cold.
Kind of chilly, but like not all really in the middle, sort of on the verge of being good, but still bad.
How is hope different than waiting?
Waiting is boring.
It's different. I guess it's a bit different because when you're waiting, you don't always know if it's good. You could be waiting for your teacher to go away that you really like, or you could be waiting for something like bad but hopeful. It could happen. And you want it to happen more.
If hope was a color and waiting was a color, what would they be?
Purple and blue.
So which one would be purple?
Purple, I guess, because purple's darker. It could be the waiting.
And blue would be hope.
Yeah.
Pink would be hoping. Black would be waiting. It's boring.
To close our show, we have a story of hopeful expectation.
Waiting isn't a skill that anyone talks about developing, really. It's not like woodworking, or horse riding, or, I don't know, playing the spoons, it's tricky, you know. No one sets aside time to practice waiting. But that's what my whole life ended up being about. My name's Simeon, by the way. Not that Simeon, the other one. And I suppose not many people remember me, my story, sandwiched there in between all the epic ones that Luke wrote about in his telling of the good news. I'm not one of the dyed-in-the-wool shepherds. I'm not a temple wise man who was wowed by little Jesus's expertise in the law. I'm just the guy who waited. Waited in expectation. That's the important bit. That's what made my waiting hopeful and not an annoyance or worse. My story started in the quiet of listening. It was a spacious silence, a silence that makes room for the Lord. I wasn't young, but I definitely wasn't old like I am now. Whew, in the middle years, I suppose. Kids, mostly grown up, but not grown up enough to not empty out your pantry every time they come and visit or dump off a load of laundry. Ah, socks and underpants. My back was, you know, just beginning to twinge. It was in those years that the Spirit of the Lord filled my silence. The Lord pulled back the curtain and showed me that I would not die before I saw Israel's consolation, before I saw the Lord's anointed one, the branch of Jesse, the light of the nations, the home come to dwell among us, even in this strange exile. Well, from that day on, I went up the hill, I went into the temple and into the courtyard, and I prayed, some days next to officials, others with the pilgrims, and I waited. And I waited, and I waited. Well, days turned to weeks, turned to months. Well, time worked the same then as it does now, pretty much. It flew by. Well, my back, it got worse. My kids had kids. Still, every day, I'd go out and wait. I'd wait in darkness for the light to come. In desolation, for consolation. Rumor got round, you know, the gossip. People would ask me, "Hey, Sim, you seen the consolation yet?" Some of them were cynical, making fun of me. "Did you miss the Christ? He was just here, looking for you." But that practice every day, kneeling, waiting, that practice sustained me. I believed. I waited. And I waited in expectation. Before I died, I would be the one. I would be the one with the welcome party who would receive the Lord's anointed. While the hair on my head became less on my head and, well, you know, more in other places, back of the knuckles, coming out the nose, thick and long. I got that type of old that you really stick out in a crowd, I tell you. Heads turn. People do double takes. And as for the sinners, as for the cynics, and the sinners and the mockers, well, they stopped making fun of me a while back. The simple reason, they didn't see it was worth it. No, not worth it to make fun of me anymore. I was almost dead, I suppose. Being alive only in the strictest, most technical definition. Well, when you get to this bent over age, death does start to get on your mind. You see it everywhere. Especially when you go to the bathroom. When you eat breakfast. And most of all, when you bend down, like when you do to pray, you expect to see death all the time. But I held on to an expectation at the same time, the expectation to see Christ. The two expectations occupying the same space for years. Every day, the silence of prayer was, well, like a pregnant woman, pregnant with expectation, both in pain and suffering, but fully with the expectation of what was to come. Death and consolation. It wasn't an either or an expectation. It was both. One day, as I finished my prayers and tried to stand up, I looked beyond and saw them. In the middle of my standing up, I groaned, but there, a young couple like all the others who would bring their sons for circumcision at the temple. I'd seen thousands of them over the years. But as I looked through my groan, changing in tones, shifting keys, I felt my groan join a chorus of other groaning that I was hearing for the first time. All around me, stones, the birds, the little plants that grew between cracks in the temple floor. All creation was groaning. And that was connected to this couple and to their kid. Well, I went over to them. I must have looked crazy, to be honest. Some random old duffer. This couple didn't know me. And I asked, "Can I hold your son?" They gave him to me. And as I held him for the first time, the waiting was over. God, you can now release your servant. Release me in peace, as you promised. For with my own eyes, I have seen your salvation. It's now out in the open for everyone to see. A God revealing light to the non-Jewish nations. And of glory for your people Israel.
All right, that's our show. Special thanks to the voice acting from Maria and Simeon. All the kids who were interviewed, Micah, Elaine, Sadie, Anya, Stella, and Etienne, and to the musicians, Melody, Maria, Gilbert, Julie, and Vanessa, and Theo Johns. Merry Christmas, Grandview!
Here I have my babies and I have my first kiss.
lightning bugs fly. I can't see too good, I got tears in my eyes. Leaving tomorrow, but I don't wanna go. I love you, my town, you'll always live in my soul. I can see a sun setting fast, and just like they say, nothing could ever last. Sunset.